All right, so let's begin by preparing to make the sound of Om together. And we'll begin by first focusing on our breath, seeing the breath going in and the breath going out. The breath in and the breath out. And with a deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Last time we met, we began the session with some eye exercises as well as some breathing exercises. They seem to take quite a while. I thought we might start today just by doing one breathing exercise. And making the sound of Om is a breathing exercise. Let's do one other, just to take us deeper into our heart space and our place of receptivity. This breathing exercise is very simple. We're going to take an in-breath and count to 10. And we're going to let the breath out slowly. And this may be a little more challenging for you. With the breath fully exhaled, you count to 10. Let the deep in breath, hold it, count to 10. And with a deep out breath, exhaust all the air and count to 10. Do one more. Deep in breath. Count to 10. And exhaust all the breath totally and count to 10. And then begin normal breathing. As you begin your normal breathing, notice who is breathing. You are not willfully breathing, are you? Your breath is natural. You could think of it as God is breathing you. Notice God breathing you. Now notice the difference between when you chose to breathe willfully with the retention and when your breath comes without your will involved. It's good to notice this because there is a message in the Bhagavad Gita, which we may see today, and that is the difference between our willful actions, may seem like most of our actions are willful, and actions that flow from us naturally. Can we be more in touch with letting what it is we do and say and think flow from our natural spiritual center? Maybe be more aware of what seems willfulness in us. This is one of the areas that Gita tries to raise our awareness. Questions or comments? We've been going through chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Yoga of Wisdom. And we're now all the way up to 42. We're going to look at a number of verses now, 42, 43, 44, 45, those are five verses. We'll look at each one, and then we'll go into an extended commentary by Satchidananda. Here we go.
I just have a short question. What does Bhagavad mean? I know what Gita means. What does Bhagavad mean? Or we can look it up later, but...
I believe it means the song of God.
Okay.
The song of God. Yes.
Interesting.
The Bhagavad Gita is a part of a very large Indian spiritual work called the Mahabharata. A huge, huge work, a lot like our Bible, deals with epic things, wars and dynasties and who begat who and so on. This is a small part of it, famous part of it. Good question. So we're going to look now, try and find some wisdom here. Here we go. In flowery discourses, the unwise focus on the letter of the scriptures and say there is nothing else. We heard Reverend Rush talk about this today in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Difference between doing what is, quote, right and acting from our natural spirit heart. In flowery discourses, the unwise focus on the letter of the scriptures and say there is nothing else. With minds full of desires and heaven as their highest goal, they speak mostly of rites and rituals, which they believe will bring pleasure and power. For example, in the rite of the Good Samaritan, when the priest walked by the injured man seemed to be dead. And one of the precepts of the religious practice of the day was it was unclean to touch a corpse. So perhaps this priest avoided that body, feeling it was a corpse and it would be unclean to touch that person. With minds full of desires and heaven as their highest goal, they speak mostly of rites and rituals which they believe will bring pleasure and power. So this is number two. Third one. Those deeply attached to pleasures and power are not able to fix their minds one-pointed in meditation and enjoy samadhi. Now, samadhi isn't a sort of a state that people on mountaintops get into. It's a state we experience but perhaps could experience more. Perhaps in the depth of the Om, what you're experiencing could be called samadhi, peace of the soul. And perhaps during the breathing exercise, with your mind taken off yourself, you might have had a few moments of samadhi.
I've experienced it, and I would suggest that it's bliss, cosmic bliss.
Mm-hmm. Cosmic bliss.
But not created by... It's just when you remove obstacles, that's what's there.
Willfulness.
Yeah.
It shows up. Those deeply attached to pleasures and powers, willfulness, are not able to fix their minds one-pointed in meditation, as we just did, and enjoy samadhi. I'm going to talk a little bit now about the three gunas to prepare us for the next verse. Are you familiar with the three gunas?
I like vocabulary words in my old age, you know. Like, you know, it's like if you don't know what a guna is, then, you know. So what's a guna?
Well, this will help us. In the Indian tradition, they don't have the Briggs-Meyer test of personality. They have the three gunas. So there are three personality types, and everyone has all the various characteristics, but one characteristic tends to dominate in most people, and it may change from morning to night during the day. So it's just a way of describing how we are. It's easiest to see it in others. So the three
like
good...
how they manifest?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, how they manifest.
Pretty balanced state and harmony. Okay, let's move on to the next one.
So the state of the guna sattva is purity, balance, state, and harmony. And we may have experienced that during our meditation this morning. But we may recall other times in recent past or when we haven't been in a state of perfect harmony.
We also experience it in moments in what you just did, which is just the laughter. In that split second, we actually experience sattva.
Some people, you may notice, just seem to be always in that balanced, harmonious state. Most of us, however, experience the rajas, activity, restless, keeping busy, doing something all the time, never willing to just...
Well, that's because everybody's identified as who they think they are in our culture, and they don't have this teaching, and so, you know, like... In my opinion, the divine masculine is what is valued in our culture, and what that means is creating work and finishing work and showing, oh, this is what I did.
Yeah.
That's called rajas in this way of looking at personality. I recall there was a time when I prided myself on being able to do many things at the same time. I thought this was a great attribute. I no longer look at it that way.
Right, wise.
But there was a time when I thought, doing all these things.
Can you give an example? I mean, what do you mean, like doing... No, I'm just curious. It's very apropos to our culture. Like, doing many things at the same time, like what?
Well, I'll give you just a simple example. I'm eating breakfast. I'm reading the newspaper. And I'm thinking of what I'm going to do when I get done with breakfast, what I have to do. So I'm not enjoying the food eating breakfast. I'm not really absorbing the newspaper. And I'm not really totally preparing myself for what comes after. I thought, well, this is great. I can do all these three things. This is a simple example. Being able... To train ourselves to have one pointed attention has many benefits. When you eat, eat. When you drive, drive. When your mind interrupts you with concerns about the future or worries at the past, and we train ourselves to notice that the mind is doing that. The mind is not who we are, it's just got a mind of its own. Bless it. Be grateful for the wonderful mind we have, thank it for sharing, and return our attention to driving, eating, or a conversation with someone, for example.
That's a wonderful teaching, and yeah, more people got this teaching, it would be a better world.
We hear this teaching a lot in the Bhagavad Gita, one pointed attention. It's not something that comes naturally to me, my mind. Usually my mind wanders off, it was doing that this morning as I was driving here, wanting to be right about something. I was imagining a conversation I had had earlier, and what I didn't say, what I wished I'd said, which would have made me more right, and them more wrong, of course. And my mind's very creative. Figured out all the ways I could have said something that would have made me more right, and then the other person wrong. And then I noticed, why am I so attached to being right? Mm-hmm. And that helped me give a little separation from my wonderful mind, which sometimes has a mind of its own.
Well, this is a huge teaching in our culture because a lot of people aren't taught this and, you know, think they are their mind. And, you know, thank God, you know, 40 years ago, I got this teaching and learned meditation and, you know, and heard the term monkey mind. Which
yes.
is related to this culture, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I heard that term, and it's huge. You know, especially imagine people with a little attention deficit. That means me. And it's like, and your mind is this fractured thing, you know. And then you know. Anyway, it's very helpful.
Just being aware.
Yeah.
That we have minds. Minds aren't who we are.
Yeah, that's huge.
They're just something we have, like fingers and hair, and we have minds. We can make good use of our hands. Oh, good morning. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
We've already begun, but you're very welcome to join us in the middle. My name's Steve.
Hi.
Welcome.
Welcome, Mike.
Are you familiar at all with the Bhagavad Gita, Mike?
Familiar in that I know what it is and I've tried to read it a few times, but
okay.
It would be nice to have someone who knew a little more than I did about it.
Good. We explore it jointly.
Yeah. Okay.
What we're looking at right now is an Indian concept called gunas. Gunas, you may have read about that. It describes, it's a way of describing our personality, aspects of our personality. So we talked about sattva, purity, harmony, rajas, which many of us experience a lot in our culture, and finally tamas, or inertia, dullness, inactivity. You may know someone who just isn't very active, sort of dull. This is an attribute. So these are the three attributes of which we could look at people. We all experience some of these attributes, perhaps all of the time. You may experience tamas at night, for example, if we're a morning person. And perhaps night persons don't experience the tamas state of night, they experience it in the morning when they don't want to get out of bed. And time to get up, they look at the clock, they say, oh, stay here a little longer. They're in their tamas state, don't want to move.
I just realized that that's part of a type of Indian medicine, which I forget the name of at the moment, but that they use these in the Indian medicine, and if you think you're way unbalanced, let's say in tamas, they have a remedy for you. Tamasic, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These states are neither good nor bad. We are born with a proclivity to have one state be our natural state, in a way we had nothing to do with it willfully. So you can see even little children who seem to be very balanced, calm and relaxed. Other children are, especially in the terrible twos, just can't stop. And some children are rather dull and inactive. Through our practices, as we grow and mature and find out more about ourselves, we can notice more about ourselves and notice how we are in or not in these various states during the day, during our life, as a way of gaining greater discernment. We will see that the Bhagavad Gita recommends we notice the state we're in, and then through spiritual practices transcend the three gunas, transcend the sattva state, rajas or tamas state, by first becoming aware in ourselves of where we are, and then you wouldn't think you'd want to transcend the sattva state, that sounds like a great place to be. And the Gita is going to recommend even that state. We, through spiritual practices, transcend.
Transcend into what?
Into the nameless. The nameless. As you hear me talk and you see these terms and so on, everyone will get a different response and different things will be triggered. So our individual truths will come up, and that's what really counts here, not any particular truth that's here. So we're on the lookout for the truths that are already inside of us, and be discerning about that. But here's a way of noticing ourselves.
So if you're in India and you meditate 4 hours a day, people would bless that and honor that. And here, if you worked, I don't know, 7 hours a day, people might judge you.
Right, it's part time, I mean, or something.
Yeah.
The whole point of these spiritual practices is to look deep inside ourselves and see what's right for us at any time.
Mm-hmm.
It may be right for you today to work 7 hours and apply your mind totally to your work and not be distracted by other thoughts and do your best. Or it may be appropriate to take a break and go to an ashram and have a weekend experience of not speaking and total silence. Experience what is yours to do. So that's the whole purpose of these teachings, to find the inner truth that's already within us and notice the difference between that and our reactive minds, which seem to know everything and seem to know what's right. So remind us all the time of what's right. Go to a deeper place and find that inner truth through discernment.
Is there something in the Bhagavad Gita that talks about that, the mind that that wants to be right, things like that?
There are different ways of explaining that. The way the Bhagavad Gita looks at it is through the medium of desire, selfish desire. The want, it's not really a need, the want to be right is truly a selfish desire. So you will see verses here about our selfish, egocentric desire. I'm right. Always right. It's a desire. When we can let loose and weaken, soften that desire to be right, it makes our life more peaceful and more satisfying.
I think it's all that self-centeredness, whether it's desire or what's going on, it's that, you know, it's all about me when
all
you're focused
me.
On,
mm-hmm.
And that's all up here. That's all ego. It's all about me.
All about me. I, me, my, you.
Right.
It's all part of the same thing, being right, selfish desire to move beyond that. Our scriptures, the Bible, we had a parable today about that. And the religious person was asked, what's the greatest commandment? Thou shalt love thy God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. And you shall love your neighbor the same way. We often focus on loving the neighbor in the same way as being the point of the parable. But the deeper meaning is, can we be in a state of loving God? How can you think of yourself and your desire to be right and have things when your mind is totally focused with all your strength, all your mind, and all your heart and soul on whatever it means to love God? I don't tell you what that means to love God. That's for you to hold and see what it means for you. I don't know what it means to love a God who you can't see. It's everywhere and inside you, and I'm not sure what that means. For me, and you need to look inside yourself and see what meaning crops up for you. So here we go, a description of the three gunas to help us look at the next verse of the Gita. Ready? Sloka 45. The Vedas, that's the scriptures, discuss the three gunas, Arjuna. By the way, the voice of the scripture here is the Lord speaking, God speaking, who is incarnated in the image of Lord Krishna. And Arjuna is the warrior who's not sure what to do, getting some advice from his inner guidance, who shows up here as Lord Krishna. The Vedas discuss the three gunas, Arjuna. Transcend the three gunas, and you will be free of the pair of opposites. What are the opposites? Right, wrong, good, bad.
Hot, cold.
Hot, cold.
Male, female.
Higher, lower.
Right, wrong, good or bad.
Good, bad.
Light, darkness.
All the opposites. Transcend the gunas and you will be free of the pair of opposites. This is an assertion. How do we know it's true? Through our experience. First, we have an intention to transcend those natural states we're born with. And perhaps with that intention, we can have some experiences now and again of not being in the grip of the gunas. Promises you will be free of the pairs of opposites, ever balanced, free of wanting to get or keep anything like being right, and centered in your true capital S self, which can also be called your Christ consciousness. In Sanskrit, it's called the Atman.
How do you spell that?
A-T-M-A-N. Translated as capital S self. Unity, we sometimes refer to it as the Christ consciousness. Transcend the gunas. How do we do that? Let's move on. So let's look at a commentary on these verses by Satchidananda. When Lord Krishna mentions the pairs of opposites, he means all dualities, pleasure, and pain. Can we move beyond pleasure and pain? Easy to state this. In our constitution, our preamble to the Declaration of Independence, it says we have the right to pursue the right.
The pursuit of happiness.
It's right in our declaration. Pursuit of happiness. And there's a lot of talk about the American dream, which is gathering things, being happy all the time. If we're focused on being happy, you can guarantee yourself you're going to feel sad at other times. So if you're happy, 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 you open yourself to feeling sad, 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 because they are opposites. That's a different state than being balanced and at peace with whatever's showing up. See that?
Mm-hmm.
So in this country, we think happiness is sort of a permanent state to be achieved. Not so, says the Gita. It's part of a duality. And we know this is true. We know people who've gotten all that money and gotten the beautiful spouse and the cars and whatever, and they're not happy. We have great movies about the rich kid associates with the poor kids. They don't have anything, but they're happy, and he wants to be happy. Actually, the poor kids aren't necessarily happy. They're just at ease with their station in life.
Some of them.
In the movie.
In the movie.
Yeah, of course, in real life, it's something else. But that's the metaphor we've grown up with.
I mean, I think you pointed to the fact that how our culture reinforces
yes.
the exact thing that actually can bring us so much pain, ultimately.
This
it
is
just,
what so
just,
many people yeah. are not at peace with. So.
You mean the ego?
Well, it's reinforcing the pursuit of happiness, you know, and that's what our ego is always out defending itself.
Pursuit of pleasure, meaning we're going to have pain in our lives. So what happens when you have pain, like my wife has severe back pain right now? How do you deal with severe pain? Pain hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Pain hurts a lot. It makes you cry. You don't feel good.
You.
Pardon?
It depletes you.
It takes your energy away. Can we prepare ourselves through spiritual practices so that as pleasures show up and as pain shows up, we can become somewhat removed from them. Not to say that it lessens the experience of it, but we've trained ourselves to notice.
Well, this is neither here nor there, but anyway, I'm just trying to be a little helpful. If I do my exercises, then I don't have hip pain. So I'm very, what is the word? Okay, if I do my exercises, no pain. Oh, good, okay, I'm going to do my exercises.
Correct.
Yes.
So there are practices we can do to help remove us from the duality of pleasure and pain, profit and loss. My 401k went down. Now it's back up again. Did I get upset when it went down? Well, a little bit. Was I happy when it went back up? Yeah, sort of. But a part of me knows that if I want to be in the 401k, I just need to be at ease with whatever the market does, profit and loss. So the way I do it is, I know that the stocks that I've invested in have a certain value. Now, if at one point some people aren't willing to pay what I think they're worth because the market's gone down, I'm at peace. If they're not willing to pay what it's worth, well, I just won't sell them to those people. Be patient.
Well, this is a huge teaching, you know, and I'm a little older and there's more loss. There seems to be more loss than there was, you know. So this is good.
Profit and loss, these are the dualities that we would like to be free of.
That one's like really embedded in our culture, you know. We go to school, we go to college, graduate, find a job, buy the house, buy the car.
All the stuff.
Yeah. It's not easy somehow to get away from that. I think it's very challenging on that one.
Of course it's a challenge.
I think it's... I know for me, the way to begin to get away from it started... It was really, I go by the phrase, pain is a touchstone of a lot of growth for a lot of people.
Sure. Yes.
And it certainly was for me. It was, you know, that's what finally made me begin to discipline myself, began to take the time to try to change.
When pain comes up, it could have, and usually has, two aspects. One is just the hurting part, which sometimes comes and goes, sometimes persists. The other part is the suffering aspect.
Mm-hmm.
The suffering aspect. And this is the spiritual or mental aspect of pain. We can do something about the suffering, even though we may not be able to do much about the experience of pain. All right, pleasure and pain. Praise and blame. Praise and blame. Do you know anyone prominent in public life that's attached to praise?
Not to get political or anything.
And who is averse to blame?
Oh my goodness.
So it's an attachment that perhaps all of us have to some degree. Someone says, good job, Mike. Oh, yeah. And then somebody says, Mike, you really screwed that up.
Mm-hmm.
You go,
mm-hmm.
It's natural for us to have some response to those kinds of communications. And yet, through our spiritual practices, can we soften the, not perhaps the initial blow of it, but the lasting or the enduring effects of it, so we can put it in perspective. Yes, I reacted. I was happy about the praise. Oh my God, I reacted to the criticism. And then next morning, through spiritual practices, put it into balance, transcending.
On Facebook, some after school things, they don't have detention anymore. They teach meditation and yoga, so they're having a great outcome. Oh my God, have you heard of that? Anyway, yeah, in some inner city places, they're starting to teach meditation and yoga.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, we grew up with praise and blame. Bless our hearts, our parents learned from their parents how to raise us. And the way to raise your kids, and when they screw up, you blame them, and supposedly that helps to fix them. Well, they're doing their best because that's how they were brought up. So all of these dualities we're brought up with. All right.
See, thank you for this illustrating the examples, allowing us to share. I think it makes the class and the experience much more deeply appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's so easy to gloss over these teachings. And yet each one could be the subject of weeks and weeks of deep personal spiritual work, depending upon where we are on our spiritual journey. And there are various techniques I'd be happy to share with you if you have a particular pressing issue, to bring to action your intent to pass beyond that. All right. I have, it's about 5 to 11 now. So we're going to close, so we have time to go to the service. And the way we like to close is by doing a breathing exercise. Take us out of our mental activity. Whatever thoughts we're having now, notice the thoughts that you're having now. Notice the thoughts. Notice if your mind is looking at what's right and what's wrong. Notice your mind. If your mind is having those thoughts, you can speak to your mind and say, thank you for sharing. Let's say that to ourselves. Thank you for sharing. Now we can bless our minds. Bless you. Wonderful minds. We're so grateful to have minds. We're so grateful to have the discernment to notice when the minds have a mind of their own, and when we use our minds for a beautiful purpose. Let's breathe three cycles, allowing our mind to empty. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. Now we'll make the sound of Om together with a deep in breath.
Very helpful. Thanks. Thank you. That was very helpful.